We'll go on to our next paper, which is to be delivered by Mr. Lacey of the Dominion Radio Astrophysical Observatory in Penticton. He will speak on a spectrographic supersynthesis radio telescope. Mr. Lacey.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Markowitz is up in the back there. I'm one of those radio astronomers that, in general, he alluded to last night. I'm glad that most of my paper is earthbound, in that although I'm speaking on the supersynthesis radio telescope, which we are building at Penticton, my interest has been mainly in the engineering aspects of this, and this very definitely is on the surface of the Earth. A spectroscopic supersynthesis radio telescope is in the design stage at the Dominion Radio Astrophysical Observatory near Penticton, BC. It is proposed that the telescope will be placed in operation in September of 1969. Now, neither the principle of operation nor the construction of a supersynthesis telescope is a new concept. But what is new is the design of a supersynthesis instrument for spectroscopic work. Now, the techniques of supersynthesis follow from aperture synthesis techniques developed at the University of Cambridge in the late 1950s. They did more work than this. There, they drew squares. In the aperture synthesis technique, two aerials are arranged so that their relative position may be altered to occupy successively the whole area of a much larger equivalent aerial. By combining mathematically the information derived from these different positions, it is possible to obtain a resolving power equal to that of the large equivalent aerial. Now, in supersynthesis, one aerial is moved with respect to the other to all possible separations in only one dimension, the rotation of the Earth being used to change the orientation of this line projected onto the celestial sphere. Until now, aperture synthesis has been applied only to studies of continuum radio emission. The possibilities presented by an application of the technique to spectral line studies provide the basis for a very powerful instrument. The availability and versatility of integrated circuit techniques for multi-channel operation, rather than the more expensive and less versatile conventional filter-type spectrometer, make feasible the construction of a spectroscopic supersynthesis radio telescope. And I got through all those words without stumbling. It's early in the morning. This is the type of telescope, then, that we are planning on building at Penticton. Our telescope will cover the frequency range from 1350 megahertz to 1750 megahertz. This includes the hyperfine lines of atomic hydrogen and the hydroxyl radical, as well as several of the electronic hydrogen recombination lines. Two 8.5 meter paraboloids will be used as the aerials for this system. These will be mounted on a movable platform and run along a special railway track with a maximum east-west separation of about 600 meters. Now, this slide is part of a map showing the site of the instrument. Those of you who have been at the observatory in Penticton will be able to orient yourself fairly well. main office building is in here, the 85-foot dish in this position. The caretaker's house and the workshop in these positions here. The east-west, proposed east-west track of the railway right through here, and a north-south arm, which may or may not be built immediately in this position here. In here is the 22 megacycle pole farm, which has been defined in various ways. However, the Vancouver Sun, I think, hit it by calling it a canine paradise. Some of the poles will be removed to allow the track to run through. Now, those of you who know Mr. and Mrs. Ray Stewart, who are the caretakers at the observatory, will realize that just about where this arrow is their bedroom. And some 20 feet away is this railroad. Ray and Dot are not at all amused or think there's anything popular about that song, "The Railroad Goes Through the Middle of the House." But they have resigned themselves to the fact that a railroad is coming in.
The north-south track, if it is installed, is necessary to facilitate observations of sources at declinations less than about 20 degrees. The observing procedure will involve tracking a region of sky for about 12 hours for each separation of the aerials, and then successive separations of the aerials will differ by about one radius of the aerial. This will involve about 150 separate operations or separate observations for the east-west track in the proposed system. A liquid nitrogen parametric amplifier and first converter will be mounted at the focus of each paraboloid. Radio frequency cables carrying signal and local oscillator frequencies from the paraboloids to a central location will be of fixed electrical length. It is proposed that a trailer will be located roughly at the junction of the two tracks here, and this is roughly midway along the east-west track, and there'll be a number of fixed-length cables running from here to a paraboloid to the east and one to the west. Phase rotation, delay compensation, and further frequency conversion, as well as telescope control and readout facilities, will be located at this central station. And the digital correlation spectrometer, to make this instrument into a spectrometer, is an integral part of the telescope. This will have an overall bandwidth of about 2 megahertz, with approximately 100 channels, each 20 kilohertz wide. The final synthesis calculations can only be done when the data for the whole observing period are available and must be carried out on a large computer. The bulk of the electronic and radio engineering aspects of the telescope are being conducted by the radio observatory staff in cooperation with the Department of Electrical Engineering at the University of British Columbia. The design and construction of the phase rotator and digital correlation spectrometer are presently proceeding, and it is hoped that these will be completed by the end of the summer. Preliminary testing of the radio frequency system has been carried out during the past few months. One item of particular interest and concern is that the radio frequency cables and amplifiers must be extremely phase stable. One parabola has been erected on a temporary concrete pad so that tracking and mechanical characteristics such as figure deformation with attitude, wind loading, differential temperature effect, etc., may be determined. Now, those of you who may think that your geography has suddenly turned east for west, I'd be relieved to know that this photograph was not taken at the radio observatory, but was taken when the telescope, or when this paraboloid, was erected at the David Dunlap Observatory in Richmond Hill.
The bulk of the structural and mechanical engineering aspects have been contracted to a consulting engineering firm, and design studies are well underway. Great precision is required in the physical placement of the two telescopes. Overall tolerances must be kept to about 1 centimeter for a wavelength of 17 centimeters. And this 1 centimeter tolerance must be observed over separations up to about 600 meters. And so this gives us a big engineering and surveying problem to overcome. It is hoped that the track can be laid with sufficient accuracy that it can serve as a primary standard for azimuth and elevation determination. And consequently, a detailed soils analysis program was conducted by the consultants prior to commencing detailed foundation studies. The analysis is now complete and is very encouraging. I've been concerned with this engineering aspect of the telescope, and at the risk of boring you, I'd like to quote in part the preliminary soils report, because it has us very excited in the construction of this track. The subsoil conditions beneath the tracks are those of outwashed terraced material consisting of stratified granular beds of sand, gravelly sand, sandy gravel, and boulderous clay. Here we're looking down 14 feet of cross-section of the earth, and this photograph was taken last fall when some excavations were made. From geological evidence, it can be inferred that no long-term settlement of the subsoil after installation of the track is to be expected. No groundwater level developed after the spring thaw. Frost penetration is slight and is of no consequence, since the underside of the track foundation shall be at a frost-free level and in non-frost-susceptible soil. And this has been a very encouraging aspect. Load-bearing tests, this is a picture of the material used for this a few weeks ago, load-bearing tests have showed a considerable variation of soil reaction upon loading. Well, the favorable soil condition has resulted in a rather simple and inexpensive roadbed foundation design. The present proposal is to excavate the topsoil to a depth of about 2 feet and replace it with ballast. This will provide sufficient loading to minimize the soil reaction and provide a good roadbed. Embedded in the ballast at about 2'6" intervals will be common cross ties securing the tracks. Such a system is economical in initial cost, provides reasonable ease and alignment of the tracks, guards against shifting with time and load, and can be realigned fairly easily should this be necessary because of severe shocks such as earthquake activity. No detailed consideration has yet been given to the surveying aspect of the project, both in terms of the initial and subsequent checking of alignment and the aerial separation determination. If anyone here has had experience along this line and would like to share some ideas with me, I'd be very happy to see you afterward. Mr. Chairman, I suspect that one of the reasons for holding the 1968 General Assembly in Calgary was that the PZT could be dedicated at an official RASC meeting, and this is a very valid reason. By the same token, perhaps the 1969 meeting can be held in Penticton, when we could hold an official ceremony for the driving of the last spike for the RAO Railroad. Driving to Calgary from Penticton, we passed a very nice-looking monument near Craigellachie, where the last spike was driven for the CPR, and it would be nice to have a similar monument in Penticton. Lord Strathcona, however, will not be able to make it. Upon completion of the supersynthesis telescope, what results can be expected? The telescope will have an angular resolution of about a minute of arc at a wavelength of 21 centimeters. This is equivalent to resolving power at the same wavelength of a paraboloid some 900 meters in diameter. The output data can be used to map a region of the sky in three dimensions, two angular or spatial dimensions, and one spectral dimension. Although considerable observing time will be required, the results will be well worth the effort and the expense. Much useful information has already been obtained from supersynthesis instruments elsewhere. I've chosen two examples from the Cambridge 1 mile instrument. This telescope consists of three 60-foot paraboloids mounted on an east-west axis. During initial testing of the instrument, a contour map of the radio source Cassiopeia A, can we have the next slide, please? This map from Cass A was produced. This ring is about 10 minutes of arc, standard and red ascension 23 hours, 21 minutes, 10 seconds, and is about 5 minutes of arc in declination. You'll notice the wealth of detail that can be realized at radio frequencies with an instrument like this. And the second source, 3C402, is representative of a survey of 82 extended extragalactic radio sources from the 3C catalog. This gives us some idea of the sort of thing that we expect to be able to produce in another year and a half or so. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Paper is open for discussion. There was a plan to construct an analog spectrometer at Cambridge. Do you know the results of that?
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
There are no further comments. We'll go on to the next paper. Is Mr. Harper, the author of the last paper on this morning's program, here? If not, then we will simply read the last paper by title. Mr. Harper's paper is entitled Some Considerations of the Origin of the Earth-Moon System. This concludes our morning session of papers, and I'd like to extend my thanks to all the authors of the papers on the first session, particularly because they kept so well to time, and we will be on time for our coffee break. However, before we have our coffee break, I'd like to introduce to the members present this morning Dr. Alan Hunter of the Hermosillo Observatory in England, and welcome him very specially to our meetings here. We're glad that he's here, not only as a representative of one of the major observatories in the world, but I understand of the Royal Astronomical Society. We welcome you very cordially, Dr. Hunter. Are there any announcements from the organizing committee before we break? If not, I'll declare this part of the meeting adjourned.